Hiram, are you familiar with Malcolm Gladwell at all? Is that just a totally new name to you?
It's a new name to me.
He wrote a book called Outliers, which is pretty famous, where he said, you know, trying to understand what distinguished high performers in a variety of different professions and sports specifically to become exceptional, and sort of explored what's called the 10,000 hour rule, which is it takes 10,000 hours of practice to become an expert. I was just curious, have you been counting your hours golf practice?
I think I'm there.
You're close.
Must be nice to be perfect. Wow. 10,000 hours or not.
10,000 hours is a lot. If I were to look at my own, I guess, so if you did 1,000 hours a year, that would take you 10 years. 500 would take you 20 years. I'd say I'm pretty close to that number based on how long I've been golfing, since it's getting close to 30 years now.
Well, so this is a bell curve, right? When do you start in the downward slide? That's what I want to know. How many hours does it take to start going
down? In other words, once you hit like 15,000, you start to suck again?
Uh-huh. I think so.
The purpose of this podcast actually is the hope that Malcolm Gladwell may listen to it in his leisure time. He may hear interesting commentators from the gentleman who I have here today joining me, as well as other guests. And he may rethink his hypothesis and realize that the game of golf is actually beautiful, although it has some, you know, specific challenges and problems like everything else in our world. Its redeeming qualities are super valuable. I wanted to do a quick introduction. So I'll start with you. I have Jan and Hiram here today. Jan, tell us your name and a little bit about yourself really briefly.
Yeah, I'm Jan Nott. I grew up in Central Africa. Started playing golf in Lusaka, which was a golf course that was fairly primitive by the U.S. standards, but by the English standards, it was an exceptional course, and it did host some touring players on the African tour, so it was well-known and well-respected. When I came to Oregon, I joined what I would thought was the best golf course in the area, a public course, because I don't believe in having the kind of exclusive rights that some private clubs impose on their members. So I joined a public course, and I'm really glad I did, because I still think it's the best golf course.
And that's how we met.
Yeah, that's how we've been met. I've been a member of the men's club at Eastmoreland Golf Course since 1978. That will age me. Anyway, as far as addiction concerns, I don't think it's an addiction to golf. I think it's an addiction to adrenaline. I think you can get that addiction on almost any sport. So let's not just hang golf on that one. Thank you.
Okay, there we go. All right, and Hiram?
Yeah, I'm Hiram Hart, and I grew up in Spokane mainly, and going to the golf course for me was like going to the park, like going to the outdoors. If you grew up in a city and you go out to the golf course and they've got ponds and trees and open space, it's quite a treat to go there. It's fun to go there. You want to go there more. And I don't blame anyone for enjoying going to Eastmoreland. A beautiful pond with birds on it and open space, and it's a challenge. Golf is a challenge. Even as you get older, like I am, you can get better because you learn technique. And it's I've been retired for 8 years now, and I've gotten better at golf because it gives me some focus for the day. It gives me some long-term focus too. You can change your swing. You can practice your chipping and putting, you can improve your score. You can have camaraderie with other players too who are out there.
Right. I should add too, by the way, Hiram, I think you, you know, from Spokane, moved here to Portland relatively recently because you lived farthest in Corvallis.
Is Corvallis right? For about 50 years, yeah.
Right, and you worked here with the post office for many years.
30 years there.
And you're still carrying your bag.
I'm still carrying my bag and walking.
You still
carry it's good exercise.
You actually, and in very very Portland spirit, you ride your bicycle to the golf course.
That's correct,
you built a special golf caddy for your bike.
You can buy these carts. They're called Burley Travois to go on the back of your bicycle. The clubs fit on there nicely. You can make I'll make the 1.5 mile trip to the course, and it works fine. It works well.
Yeah. That's an advantage of having a course that's in the center of town. I mean, there's a course in Belfast in Northern Ireland where I was able to drag my golf clubs on my carts through the streets of Belfast and get to the golf course in about 20 blocks. So this open space, whether it's a golf course or any other open space, has some value from that point of view.
Yeah. Yeah, and East Moreland was specifically created as a golf course that was right along a trolley line. So what is now the Max Line? Max Line is a our metro train here in Portland, Oregon. You know, you'll see people with their golf clubs on the Max Line coming to there. So specifically, I brought both of you here today to talk a little bit more about open space and birds, because I know you're both avid birders, and that's something that you both, in our conversations, one thing that I love about golf is that it's a 4-hour conversation. You get to know three other people really well. The club itself is really just a way for people from all walks of life to get together, compete, and get to know one another. And with both of you, I've learned more about birds because you would point them out while we were playing.
Not always a good thing if you're in a competition, but
who cares?
It's match play.
Yeah. Well, apparently Jan mentioned too, you like to use you have binoculars in the bag.
If I'm playing badly, I'll take my binoculars out. It looks like a rangefinder, so nobody can really complain about it. But yeah, I will look at birds.
So one of the things that I looked back, you might be familiar with Alistair McKenzie, one of the famous golf architects from the golden age of golf. And he has one of his most famous quotes is the chief object of every golf course architect is to imitate the beauties of nature and so closely as to make the work indistinguishable from nature itself.
Well, that's pretty noble. As I understand, the game of golf grew up in fields and natural areas. So they're trying to imitate those old natural areas. That's what the sand traps are about. They were playing on sandy, duny country near the coast. Mm-hmm. And so one of the challenges was to get out of sand. Now you have to build them artificially, but that's the intention. And of course, water, because most of the time the early golf courses were around standing water or near the ocean or near lakes. So that's part of the new architect's ambition is to build something that looks like or feels like or plays like the original game of golf.
Mm-hmm.
So
I talk about that in an episode called Golf is Made by the Land. So in other words, it's a game that grew up, that really evolved out of the actual unique Lynx land of Scotland and also Ireland. And how this relates to our conversation about wildlife is the Lynx land is rather new land. So it's old seabeds that had, after the time of the glaciers, there was like a withdrawal of the water tables. And as I understand it, Lynx land is actually a combination of soil that's being eroded from inland and then bird guano, or basically the birds have actually been an essential kind of part of creating that ecosystem because seabirds mm-hmm. like to nest.
Yeah. I think the Bandon Golf Course down on the coast of Oregon comes the closest to having that ecology as a natural feature. And that's why it's become so successful.
You mentioned you were going to go to the coast today, Hiram. You're going to head out there today.
That's correct.
Are you going birding?
I'm always birding. I'm learning. Don't know as much as Jan does, but it's another thing you can learn about as you get older. And at the Crystal Springs Lake, I believe it's called, on Eastmoreland, it's quite a large body of water, and many birds are there year-round. We have, the Canada geese are there, and the smaller variety, the cacklers, come in the winter, and they create a lot of guano. You know,
yes, they do.
I hope they're enriching the course. Natural, sometimes I'm not sure.
Natural fertilizer, I think.
Yes. But some of they have a very pretty wood duck. You know, the mallards are there. We have gadwalls. We have widgeons. We have grebes. And we have, in the winter, it's even better. The buffleheads come in, these little birds with a white breast, and they're diving ducks. And when they dive under, first they jump up in the air a little bit, then they dive. And there's like a flotilla of buffleheads. There'll be like eight of them together, and they're all jumping up and diving in. And so it's really a pleasure for me to watch the birds when I'm at Eastmoreland. I think some of the people I play with, they don't even notice. But I've seen, we have a pair of nesting eagles there, too, and they're very special. And I actually, one of my favorite days I was playing golf, I was out there on the 17th tee, and there's a pond you have to go over to hit your shot. It really makes you hit a good shot there. There's no bailout. But there's a tree that the eagles nest in is close by, and I heard the eagles talking to each other, this chit, 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 up high. And then one of them circles around and around and lands in the top of a tree there. And then the other one circles around and around. Where are they going to land? Well, right on top of the other bird. I saw the eagles actually,
mating?
Mating.
It's called mating, yeah.
Yes, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, it was one of my best days at Eastmoreland. I don't know what I shot that day, but I was out there and watching the birds and having a great day. So,
yeah, the bald eagles are a recent addition. I think about 3 or 4 years ago they showed up and started nesting. They need a tall tree. They need a body of water. And that all exists, and they need a food supply. And they're it all exists at Eastmoreland. And so they moved in. Bald eagles range are expanding rapidly since they got rid of DDT. It's a real success story for science.
Let's talk about that for a minute, because let's talk about that for a minute, because I brought some interesting, I did a little bit of research myself. DDT is, of course, a very famous pesticide that, I think was talked about a lot in the very famous book Silent Spring, or at least DDT was, considered some, magical chemical that was going to make this world a better place, and yet it had some very serious impacts on the wildlife and the ecosystem, and really our own health as well.
Mm-hmm. That's right. I mean, there's some controls for insects, which we consider to be essential to keep our health, like keeping malaria down means eliminating mosquitoes. Well, in my mind, it would be better to eliminate the malaria bug and keep the mosquitoes to feed other animals, because mosquito larvae feeds fish, mosquitoes feed birds and bats. So if we could possibly do that, rather get rid of the virus that is, well, no, it's not a virus, the disease that the mosquito carries would be a much better way of spending our time, I think.
Well, if Bill Gates has any way about it, he's definitely making big headroads in that. You know, the reason, we bring that up is because a lot of people think of golf courses as being, as Malcolm Gladwell said, pesticide infested or just drenched in chemicals. And I actually did a little bit of research. I'm going to share some pieces with you, because I think what's important to recognize is that was probably true. That was true. Not probably true. It was true 40, 50 years ago. It really was, but it was also true if you were to look at agriculture and you were to look at, like the military in Vietnam. I mean, the use of chemicals in the 50s, 60s, and 70s was literally, we were drenching the world in chemicals. What I discovered, what was interesting, is in the 1990s, there was a real big change, led in part by some of the important groups like the Audubon. But in the 90s, there became a certified Audubon courses through the USGA with the objectives of, one, enhancing wildlife habitats on golf courses, two, encourage active participation in conservation programs by golf courses, as well as the golf course superintendents and the general public. Three, to recognize people who are actively participating in environmentally responsible projects. And four, educate the public and the golfing community about the benefits of golf courses and the role they play relative to the environment and wildlife. And in the 90s, there was actually a study done in Iowa where they discovered that golf course superintendents had higher rates of cancer and a higher mortality compared to the general public. It was maybe not as high as miners.
That's a wake-up call, I'm sure.
That was a wake-up call. And I think that was probably a wake-up call to understand, too, that it's not just a PR movement. Mm. It was an awareness by the golf community, by the people most intimate with the golf courses themselves, that they were putting their own lives and families at risk. And in New York State, where I'm from, was one of the first states to begin to mandate the reduction in pesticides across all parks. And New York State, of course, manages one of the most famous golf courses in the world, Bethpage Black. And in the 90s and then leading into the 2000s, they made a deliberate effort in coordination with Cornell University. And we've seen similar efforts here in Oregon with Oregon State University and turf grass programs to reduce the amount of pesticides and fungicides and other types of chemicals and even using organic fertilizers by as much as 50 to 90%. And so we're seeing a massive change in that industry, which has been recognized by the Audubon.
I think everybody's benefiting from that. You can see benefits at the golf course almost immediately just by the fact that the bald eagles returned. And that's keeping a number of geese under control. So these are natural controls and restoring some natural balance between predators and prey, which is quite important. Rather than imposing our chemicals on the environment to try to control it our way, let it control itself. These things have a way of balancing out.
Right. The other part, too, that comes into play, and I know that when you're a birder, it's also an awareness of other parts of the ecosystem. So the fauna, the trees become important. I know that when we were helping Eastmoreland with their Audubon certification, a butterfly garden was proposed.
Butterflies are definitely an issue because they migrate across the United States in winter in Mexico. And I'm not saying that one butterfly does that. They do it in stages. But they do require food and food source and to sustain their caterpillars on the way and to help their journey. So if we can provide these food sources, and there's quite a movement to start planting the plants that butterflies require to sustain them. So that's something that's happening on all public lands, I think, removing invasives that don't feed the native insects and birds and replacing them with indigenous plants.
Yeah, I think the many courses I've played lately have environmentally sensitive areas. People aren't even allowed to walk there. And I think Eastmoreland may have to establish something like that near their ponds to keep people away, because these are natural areas that support birds and support insects and important in the environment and ecology. So, we all support that, I think, and it makes it better to play golf out there in situations like that.
I totally agree with you, Hiram. I was just talking to Billy the other day and saying that, the course superintendents remove dead limbs from the trees. Of course, they have to do that because of the insurance policies and danger to people who play. But instead of removing a dead limb, if there's a possibility of just putting a no-go sign around that tree until the limb fell by itself, that might be a solution because, you know, dead branches foster insects, and the insects feed woodpeckers and birds and other animals. So it's just the always other solutions to the obvious one sometimes we might look at.
Well, you shared that interesting story about the tree that fell on 4. You remember that, Hiram?
The tree on 4. I don't recall that right now.
That fell across the green.
Oh, remember? Yes.
Yeah, there were actually tree. Wood
near
ducks.
Near Johnson Creek.
Yeah.
There were wood ducks nesting on that tree. I saw them coming in and out of a hole where that tree was dead. So the fact that it was kept there probably fostered a couple of wood duck families before it actually fell over. But, yeah, we could just mark those off and say this is an unsafe zone until it becomes safe again, instead of just cutting everything out and making it all look like we want it to look.
That's a nice area down there, right near Johnson Creek. And it's a warm area because it's the hill blocks the wind, and it's sunny at that end of the course. And it's even in the winter, it's a special area anyway.
Yeah,
I would agree. That little dog leg. So the fourth hole is a short dog leg. It's a great dog leg because driver's basically out of play. I actually can pull driver in the winter. I guess you guys probably...
We hit drivers.
You guys hit drivers. So the fairway runs out about 270, but in the summer it's hard, so you can go right through into the woods with a driver. The 3-wood is the play for me, and some guys play a hybrid, but it takes a very precise shot. I mean, really, the even though it looks like you've got, you know, a pretty straightforward dog leg, the trees on the left side of the inside of the dog leg, so the dog leg is a left turning dog leg, it requires you to hit it pretty precisely about 210 to 235.
Well, let's say that a lot of holes at Eastmoreland require precise shots.
Yeah.
That's right. And that's one of the values of the course, is that it was designed by H. Chandler Egan, and he has designed many courses. And so part of the enjoyment of playing is that it is a challenge, and it's well designed, and and so that's all.
And that hole runs up against Johnson Creek, and the city has done a huge amount of work on restoring Johnson Creek for salmon runs, and I think they're getting some success finally. They've removed culverts, and they've restored they've put logs in the river to create ponds, and so this has done a huge amount. So we can actually go and look at Johnson Creek at any time. That's one of the advantages of the golf course. You can go see what's going on, watch animals and birds coming back, which has really been fun over the last 30 years.
Yeah, it's a pretty spot down there.
It really is. Yeah, I have an article from the Eastmoreland 100. I don't know if you guys read that, called Golf Ball Eating Salmon Roaming Municipal Links. And it's about the superintendent going down there during a flooding of the Johnson Creek, which I guess happened more often in the past, and having found like a giant salmon. And they said, you know, people have been saying this, you know, salmon's been eating our golf balls, that kind of thing. I think it was more tongue-in-cheek kind of an article.
That's for sure.
However, I have heard stories where, you know, golfers said that even, you know, 50, 60 years ago, there were salmon.
There was definitely a run of androgynous fish up the creek, because I've seen a young kid. They used to open the course to kids under 12 to go fishing at the base of the waterfall on 17. And I actually saw a kid catch about a 2-foot long. I'm not sure if it was a salmon or a steelhead, but anyway, he caught this nice big fish.
Where would they sit, on the bridge?
They were sitting on the bridge and fishing down into the pool.
That's so cool.
Yeah. So
that's a different time and age, because guys are shooting, you know, they're playing golf right over them, right?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
So this actually brings up something that I wanted to suggest. You know, when I did the Eastmoreland 100 celebration, I had a lot of grand ideas of ways to engage the community and the public. One of them was I wanted to host a bird watching tour, and I was actually going to rely on you two to lead it. So,
first I heard about it, Billy.
I think Hiram's pointing to Jan.
You're putting me on the spot here.
I'm putting you on the spot, but guess what I learned about that was really interesting? The Audubon, through a collection of golf courses, hosts something called the North American Birdwatching Open. I wonder if it might be, you two would probably be like the shoo-ins to win it, so we might have to handicap you, but play a round of 18 and then also have a score sheet of how many birds you see.
Yeah, counting birds while you're playing golf.
Well, I'm sure there's some guys in the club that would not approve of that as an event.
Not during a tournament anyway, for sure.
Well, yeah. All these guys can learn, though. I don't know how many times I pointed out to my playing companions, look at that bird there. That's a... We have, Jan will know this, a bird with a
water tree.
A snout, no, with a clip on the, it's got on its, anyway, there's several.
No, let's hear about it. I want to see if Jan can figure it out. This is what I do with Jan.
Tell me if it's on the lake.
In the clubhouse.
It's on the lake.
It's on the lake swimming, right?
Merganser.
It's a merganser.
Hooded merganser.
A hooded merganser, beautiful, beautiful bird.
Oh, yes, and they had babies there last year.
Yes.
And it's fairly rare. I mean, but I point these out, and the guys I play with are learning now. They might know the difference between a gadwall or a widgeon or a merganser, you know, and I think they appreciate it too. Yeah. I really do.
Well, not only golfers enjoy the area, but they have a rash of photographers on the other side of the golf course, Crystal Springs. They can look over the golf course. And, of course, the reason all the photographers were out there, that we had a visiting mandarin duck, which is not a native bird, but they're native to East Asia. But
really?
There are some collections around the local area. So every now and again, one either escapes or gets out and goes onto the lake, onto the Crystal Springs area, because, you know, people feed the ducks there, and they feed the geese corn. So the geese and ducks are pretty tame. So
escapes, you mean like from a zoo?
It's probably, no, they're private collections. Nobody quite knows where this one came from. Mm. But they do show up occasionally, and then they disappear again. So this one was at Eastmoreland for about a week, and there were just probably 150 photographers there at different times. You'd see three or four or five a time during the day.
Right.
Of course, I was there too. This is a spectacular duck. It's related to the wood duck, but it's so much more colorful. It's incredibly beautiful.
And I'm curious too. So, Jan, I know you're connected with the wildlife refuge in Southern Oregon.
Oh, the Malheur.
Malheur.
Yes. Yes, there's a wildlife refuge up in central Oregon,
right,
which is an inland lake system, and it attracts migrating wildfowl, and they overwinter there, numerous geese. And Eastmoreland's not quite on that migrating route, but because it's attractive and it's close by, we do get some migrating birds. I've seen white pelicans flying over Eastmoreland. I've seen... We had a white-fronted goose last week, a greater white-fronted goose.
What were the pelicans that I photographed at Heron? Like, I remember one time I described birds flying overhead, and I was like, what kind of bird is that? And then I came to the clubhouse and described it. It was sort of, you know, it looked like a A-10 warthog, in my opinion. and I was like, what kind of bird is that? And you said a pelican, and I was like, pelicans?
Yeah, the white pelicans, American white pelicans, they breed on Klamath Lake all year. But they do fly sometimes. If they find a food source, they will fly. And I think the Heron Lakes has a lot of catfish that have been planted there in the past, and that it does attract these birds. Unfortunately, the catfish tend to grow too big for them, so they will take out the smaller ones and the big ones, and will keep breeding. I've never seen them landing on Crystal Springs. It's probably just too small for them to actually land and take off again.
Mm.
But bigger lakes, they will definitely.
You know, and I noticed too, like, obviously Heron Lakes is called Heron Lakes. Heron has a lot of herons, and now crane-like birds that are showing up too? So white ones?
They got cormorants. I don't know if they have cranes. Quite possibly they have a crane stopping over on the way on migration.
I think Billy's talking about egret here, though.
Probably an egret.
The great egrets, would be great egrets.
Yes.
And, yeah. They also have, it's called Heron Lakes because of the green herons, and it's a favorite place for people to go out and photograph green herons because normally they're very skulking and you never see them.
But I've got 1,000 photos of them. If you go to my Instagram feed, it's mainly golf and herons.
Yeah.
Or am I talking about the blue herons?
You're talking about the great blue herons.
The great blue herons.
Oh, blue. Blues are around, but greens are harder to see. Yeah, so maybe I haven't photographed one.
They're smaller, like crow size.
Right.
They fly fast.
And that's what brings up habitat. I mean, birds, each species requires a specific type of habitat because that's what they fitted into over their evolution. And the green heron is very secretive. It stalks its prey on this riverbank. Usually it likes to have a wood outlying across the water so it can stab fish. It catches fish, catches frogs, any small mammals, mice, whatever it can get a hold of. But it's skulking because it stays hidden in the riverbank. And the other day I actually saw a Virginia rail on one of the logs on the side of, not the golf course side, but the other side. So these birds require specific habitats as well. They like to have reeds that are slightly open at the bottom, and that's something else that the golf course in the city is trying to do is get rid of that yellow flag iris, which has taken over. It's an invasive species. It's taken over a lot of the... We used to have numbers of red-winged blackbirds breeding on Crystal Springs up against the golf course.
And I remember.
We have about
a couple of
breeding pairs left. And I think it's because the bulrushes disappeared and yellow flag iris took over. So the city is removing yellow flag iris and restoring bulrush. We should get red-winged blackbirds back again.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, that's what I've come to understand too, is that the ecosystem really is...
It needs management.
Yeah.
It absolutely needs management, but it needs the right kind of management, not too much. I mean, there's a lot of activity removing blackberry bushes, and yes, they're a menace, but they do actually feed birds during the winter. They feed sparrows, a lot of junco.
During the winter?
Yeah, junco and sparrow. Well, the blackberries will desiccate, dry up, you know, the seeds are... Still
they
viable.
Like old blackberries.
Yeah.
I see what you're saying.
So they'll be in the blackberry bushes and looking for seeds all year. But you remove all the blackberries, well, then you have to put something else back in there, which I think is happening too. They're putting ribes species.
I was actually reading about a species of fauna called the duck potato.
Not familiar with that.
Yeah, it was basically used by indigenous peoples here.
Are you talking about Wapato?
Yes, Wapato.
Okay.
Yes, actually, exactly, Wapato.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That seems to be another kind of important species, certainly before when the indigenous peoples were here, that was the Multnomah Indians, which would have been living in the ecosystem. Sauvies mm-hmm. Island was basically, as I understand it, their primary place, and that was known as a Wapato.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, sure. I think land that has been flooded by rising rivers flood every year, and then the floods go down. That's the normal nature of the ecosystem, and lots of birds have evolved to take advantage of that as the rivers flood, and when they recede, they leave behind a lot of food supply.
Yeah. And we talked about something else. I recorded it earlier, but I'll bring it up now. Because Hiram, you moved to Eastmoreland within the last 5 years, right?
Yes, 2.5 years ago,
a
little more.
Did you play Eastmoreland like 20 years ago? Did you ever travel up from Corvallis to play in any events?
I've played there only once or twice before.
Did you ever play Eastmoreland before the trees were limbed? When all the trees grew all the way to the ground, all the limbs were all the way to the ground?
Yes, I did. And people didn't like it when they limbed them up.
No.
But It's fine with me. I don't see any problem.
Well, as a golfer, I will say it's very fine with me because when the golf ball is under, you know, what kind of trees are they actually?
There's so many different kinds. There's
mostly cedars, but there's also larch. There's some Doug fir, not too many.
Yeah.
When they planted the golf course back in the 20s, I understand that they bought out a tree nursery somewhere, and this tree nursery had a huge number of specimens from all over the country. And even all over the world, they have monkey puzzle trees in some place.
That's right. There's a monkey puzzle on the 18th tee.
Yeah, and as a result, they have some really beautiful specimen flowering trees, especially the plums, and all through the course, and they've been really well planted. So you do have plum blossoms in the spring, and you have winter, fall maples, fall leaves. So it's a beautiful place, and it evolves over through the year. And of course, the larch lose their needles every year. So a lot of people say, well, those cedars are dying. And I said, no, they're larch, and they normally lose their needles, so get used to it.
Yeah. Well, I noticed there's some trees, like the tree on one, that tree's probably an original tree from off to the left on one, the tree that covers that
green.
Yeah,
I don't think they've replanted, and that's one of my issues at one point, because these maples don't live forever. You know, they have a limited lifestyle, and there are a lot of maples are dying back gradually, and I don't see any replanting efforts, but this may be something that should be addressed.
That's why we need people like you, Jan, out there on the committee to help out.
Well,
and make suggestions to the grounds crew.
Yeah, they've done a good job on the cherry trees, keeping them not overly trimmed. They've done a really good job on the plum trees. They take out, just remove the dead branches without limbing them up, which is really nice. But I think some of those maples have to be removed and replanted somehow, but that's a huge effort.
Yeah, well, there's a movement too among golf. I mean, originally Smoreland Course was much more, I mean, it was originally a cow pasture, so there really was, even though it had a undulation or dairy pasture.
It was originally a forest.
Well, it was a forest.
The reason they called Portland Stumptown is that was a forest.
Yeah. So, well, exactly. Going back into indigenous peoples, it was, mm-hmm. This was a confluence of right, Johnson Creek going into, eventually the Columbia and all the different rivers, mm-hmm. the Willamette River. Or which was used to be called the Multnomah River, which, of course, is named after Indian tribes. You know, there's a lot of virtues of the open space in golf, and a lot of these golf courses have preserved habitats which are oftentimes adjacent to wetlands without necessarily impacting the wetland or the animals in a negative way.
It's normally not an area that's easily developed. They tend to put golf courses on land that wasn't difficult to develop anyway, not the easiest.
Right. By the train station, the train line goes right by it, as well as if you go out to the courses by the Columbia, like Heron, it's by the airport.
And they always seem to be on lower ground, too, except mm-hmm. for the one in up in Westland. But anyway, they tend to be. So you tend to end up with houses looking down on them, which is nice, but it's also puts them in the spotlight for a lot of people, developers who would like to say, well, I can see that wonderful green open space. Let's do something with it. This kind of effort that we're doing now is to say, well, okay, these spaces have value beyond monetary value, and in fact, they can be monetarized if you do it right. But they have value to more than just humans. And then you might say, well, let's just turn everything into a golf course, but that's really not the answer.
something. Let's turn everything into a golf course? Maybe that is the answer, Jan.
We got to live somewhere.
bunker on the 18th
hole. There we go.
Yeah.
One thing that I would add is the golf course has value, too, for a place for people to go and to meet and to have some camaraderie. And we've developed, especially a retired community, we've started a game on Tuesdays and Thursdays at noon where it's a reduced price because you pay up front to the city a certain fee, and then you can play at these times that normally people don't play very often, and you can play for a reduced rate, and they fill up the course, and we, you know, have a little food or drink afterwards, and it's the value of that I don't think should be diminished either. That you know, that I've had friends and that I've made at the golf course, and so that part of it, the reason to maintain a golf course and not turn everything into housing, is that it is a place to meet and make friends and.
Yeah, and go for a walk outside. I mean,
oh, absolutely.
One of the elements that you brought up in the beginning, actually, before we wrap, I want to touch on this. I find value in being on a golf course in part because it is a relatively a slow walk, and you're in and amongst the trees. You're oftentimes closer to the trees, or you get to know the land more intimately, because when you're ball is in the woods, like near the roots, you begin to understand the root structure of a tree, because it actually is going to impact your shot selection.
Yes. Or you... I always, whenever we get caddies, we have this caddy program. Give me the name. Okay, anyway.
I'm slipping on it, too.
It's a very famous caddy program where young students are asked to caddy during the year in exchange for scholarships. And every time I get a caddy, I always say, okay, what's that tree called? And can you see that bird? What is that? What is, you know, in other words, make them more aware of their environment than they normally, because most of these kids are students sitting in a classroom with a computer.
Yeah.
And studying deeply, and they're usually very, very intelligent young kids.
The Evans Scholars.
Evans Scholarship.
The Evans Scholars,
yes,
which is a scholarship created by Chick Evans, who was a great golfer from Chicago back in the 20s.
So I always challenge the caddies I'm with, okay, I want you to name three trees and then go and look them up, you know.
And they're like, well, oh man, we got Jan, the biology ecology test giver. Uh-huh. Am I going to have to do this to get your signature for the credit for my round?
You bet.
Good for you. I mean, that is a part of it. What those Evans scholars are experiencing that Chick Evans really intended was to give a younger person that ability to go experience, you know, spend 4 hours with,
mm-hmm. with old, you know, older men,
older,
I know.
Older guys, and older women.
And older women.
The Ladies Club
exactly.
is really a really critical part of the Evans
That's,
Club as
right.
well.
Exactly.
And it's interesting. I think about it, like I get, you know, muddy out on the course. I get a lot of people, by the way, here in Portland because of, you know, it's so famous for its outdoor activities. You know, where people are like, let's go hiking. And I've often said hiking is a golf game spoiled. I mean, what's the point of hiking? You know, if I'm going to walk 6 miles,
exactly.
I want to score at the end. But I feel that. I was like, I can go to, you know, Eastmoreland or Heron Lakes or Stone Creek, or, you know, now I've got friends that could take me out to Waverly or Riverside, or go over to Pumpkin Ridge, or, you know, hop on the car and drive out to play Tethero or Bandon. And, you know, each of those experiences, you get something different and new. So for me, you know, I played at golf in New Mexico and just recently, as well as I played in Phoenix. And I noticed, you know, the birds are just completely different.
They're different birds.
They're so different.
Absolutely. We need to buy you some binoculars.
Yeah.
Then you can go hiking more often. You have a purpose.
I'm sure I've got some guys in the club that would give me multiple stroke penalties if they saw that I was actually...
No, that would be for your hiking, Billy.
No, for my hiking.
Golf.
Oh,
yeah,
not for golf.
You can go count birds and you have a score at the end of your hike.
I would say that there's something about that is, you know, that it is birding in a way is a way of really being out there and appreciating nature too, and getting out there into the wilderness, right? I mean, you
totally.
Go out and explore places which you wouldn't otherwise go.
Absolutely. You're looking for birds, looking for different birds in different habitats, and you're generally, it gives you a focus on the environment so that you have some reference what's happening in the world.
Right. Yeah. And things like the weather. Yeah.
In either case, you're exercising, you're hiking, you're playing golf, and it has to be something that you enjoy doing, because that's what gets you back out there.